Sunny spells after frosty starts, temperatures generally about 5 to 8 Celsius. And that's the forecast.
Thanks, Alex. Now, on BBC Radio 4, it's time for our new Book of the Week, which tells the extraordinary story of the wife of the famous Russian composer Sergei Prokofiev. The Love and Wars of Lina Prokofiev by Simon Morrison is read by Sean Thomas.
Among the few possessions to survive from Lina Prokofiev's 8 years in the Soviet gulag is a battered burlap sack. The makeshift bag is just large enough to hold the scores of the French, Italian and Russian arias that the once aspiring operatic soprano sang in prison and taught to other women in the barracks. Among the pieces of remembered music was a song by Chopin called The Wish. It tells the tale of a woman so devoted to her beloved that if she were the sun, she would shine only for him, and if she were a bird, would sing for him alone. For Lina, the song offered an escape into the memories of an earlier time. She had learned it long before. And in the extreme north of the Soviet Union, where she was imprisoned in 1948, it spoke to the power of imagination in a place of mind-numbing barrenness. Born on the 21st of October, 1897, on Calle de Barbara de Braganza in Madrid, Lina inherited her chestnut hair and dark, heavy-lidded eyes from her father, but otherwise she was very much her mother's daughter, courageous, impetuous, and relentless once committed to something. Her father, Juan Codina, who began his musical career singing at the Catedral Basilica de Barcelona, became a professional tenor and amateur composer of songs with a Catalan flavour. Her mother, Olga Nemiskaya, was a fair-haired, grey-eyed soprano from Odessa. They were not poor, but their finances were precarious, and in December 1907, the family sailed from Boulogne-sur-Mer for New York. They settled in Brooklyn, where Lina went to school, and her parents made a modest living performing and teaching voice. Lina, hiding under the piano, sometimes listened to the lessons. She absorbed some of the Italian opera repertoire from Olga and basic music theory from Juan, and she soon began to study voice with them herself. Among the people who cared for her while her parents were away performing was Vera Danchakov, a remarkable woman scientist. Danchakov and her husband presided over lavish dinners with successive generations of relatives and friends carefully arranged around the table. The patriarchal vignette remained in Lina's mind, testament to the important social connections that her parents had forged in Russian émigré circles in New York. By the time Lina was 21 in 1918, the émigrés brought with them descriptions of the chaos that followed the Russian Revolution, the shootings on the streets of Petrograd, the snipers on the roofs, the political leaflets blowing down the street, the abdication of the Russian Tsar in February 1917, and the Bolshevik takeover. Coming into her own as a young woman, as soon as Lina finished school, she was instructed to find a profession, a métier, rather than relying on marriage and motherhood. So she learned basic secretarial skills while continuing with her singing lessons. Before long, she landed a position at the American Committee of the Russian Cooperative Unions, a trade organization which housed a telegraph office, along with a branch of the Moscow People's Bank. One of the clients at the bank was a blue-eyed, blonde-haired composer and pianist, visiting New York from Russia. He was well on his way to controversial fame in Europe and the United States, and he made no secret of his disdain for the pompous music of the romantic composers whom New York audiences still held dear. The American media dwelled on his ferocious, mechanistic technique at the piano, and the cacophonies of works, like his second piano concerto and Scythian suite. In person, he was much less bizarre and eccentric, than the musician who loped across the stage to wreak havoc on Steinway's. He was beleaguered by a touring schedule that taxed his strength, leaving him frail, even gaunt. But his icy intellect allowed him to remain focused on his purpose, the musical conquest of the new world. Now and again the newcomer came to the bank to wire funds to his mother, who was trapped in Russia during the revolution. His name was Sergei Prokofiev. Lena first saw him on the 10th of December 1918 at a performance at Carnegie Hall that featured his first piano concerto. Sergei Prokofiev pursued his career in the West with the permission of Russia's Bolshevik government, on the understanding that he would serve as a kind of cultural diplomat. Sergei honoured the agreement, keeping his assessment of post-revolutionary Russia positive in conversation with American reporters, never risking his good relationship with the Bolshevik regime and its foreign agents. For some time, Lena went unnoticed among the women at Sergei's beck and call. Dagmar Gadovsky, the dark-haired daughter of the composer Leopold Gadovsky, was just starting her career as a silent film actress and would later be romantically linked to Rudolph Valentino and Charlie Chaplin. Sergei succumbed to her advances, declaring her a hell of a girl in a late-night diary entry. But the affair ended as soon as it began, the moment he met the 18-year-old Stella Adler. Sergei found Stella enchanting, and she fell hard for him too, but their personalities clashed and circumstances pulled them apart. Lena and Sergei were brought together by a mutual friend, Alexei Stahl, who invited Lena to Staten Island on successive weekends in the autumn of 1919. Lena's mother was against her making the trek, suspecting that Sergei's intentions were not wholesome. Sergei, Lena, and some of the other guests took to the water on that first afternoon on flatboats in Wolf's Pond Park. He thumped his vessel into hers, threatening her with an unexpected swim as she lurched to and fro, almost capsizing. Stahl invited them to his house again, and a November afternoon ended with the two piling up leaves in the garden and lighting a bonfire. Returning to Manhattan, she provided the details to her mother. Olga decided that she had no choice but to assess Sergei in person by inviting him to dinner. At the Kodina's apartment uptown, he turned on the charm, flattering Olga and indulging her anecdotes about Russia while contributing his own. She could not help but like him. Olga sanctioned the relationship, but not before warning her daughter about being seen with Sergei in public and suggesting that they meet under her supervision at home. Lena defied her, accepting Sergei's invitation to afternoon strolls in the theatre. She was apprehensive about going to his apartment, but he finally harried her into visiting him. These initial weeks of courtship were full of ambivalence. Lena was torn about being alone with Sergei, but found herself at his place ever more frequently. Sergei nurtured the thought that she was the perfect partner for him, the woman he had long been seeking. By December, he knew she adored him, writing that, "It is a long time since anyone loved me as this dear girl seems to do." Lena, full of earnest affection, endured the mild mockery, indulged his moods, and offered herself as a source of support. Perhaps, she thought, she could be the one person to break through his cerebral exterior and enchant him. Or perhaps, given that all of his love went into his art, he would make her his muse. The relationship solidified, and they spent Christmas together as he pushed through the orchestration of Love for Three Oranges. He explained that the opera was a send-up of opera itself, treating satirically the conventions of the genre and the behaviour of its audiences. The plot concerns a hypochondriac prince who takes ill after overindulging in Jean Racine's tragic verse. Laughter is the cure, but it comes at the expense of an accident-prone sorceress, Fata Morgana, who curses the convalescent prince with the need to find and consume three fantastically oversized oranges. These conceal beautiful princesses, one destined to become the prince's bride. By mid-February, Sergei and Lina had made tentative plans to spend the summer together in Paris, he fulfilling a commission with the Ballet Russe, she perhaps taking singing lessons. But Stella Adler's return to New York clouded his thinking and stirred his latent passion. He maintained a punishing schedule in the spring of 1920, beginning another opera, The Fiery Angel, before the ink was dry on Love for Three Oranges. He also accepted several concert engagements, and he saw Lina less frequently and continued his pointless dalliance with Stella. In 1920, Sergei left New York for Paris, and 2 months later, Lina followed after Olga received word that her daughter would be met by trusted family friends. Her arrival coincided with that of Sergei's mother, Maria, who, emaciated, sallow-skinned, and almost blind from cataracts, had managed to escape southern Russia, travelling with defeated White Army soldiers to Constantinople and thence to Marseille. Sergei introduced Lina to his mother, papering over the details of their relationship. Lina was one of his American friends, he hedged, who just happened to be in Paris taking voice lessons. Maria, certainly no fool, chose not to fret about the details of the relationship, since she found Lina pleasant and much more attentive to her needs than her distracted son was. Lina saw in Sergei's mother the key to his heart, and she showed her devotion to him by running errands for her and teaching her English. Back in Paris, Sergei arranged for them to live at the Hotel du Quai Voltaire. He could no longer conceal the nature of his relationship with Lina from his mother, but Sergei soon escaped the awkwardness, departing with a kiss for each for the United States in October. Their only contact now came through letters, Lina's long and frequent, his short and to the point, often ignoring her questions. Behind the letters, however, lay a bigger chasm, one that both of them should have recognised as fraught with personal and professional danger. Lina had turned out like her parents, exotic, impulsive, scattered, while Sergei was focused and obsessive in his creative pursuits. Lina believed she could bridge the divide between their temperaments by becoming someone special, by making a name for herself. But no matter what she achieved as a singer, nothing could compare to Sergei's gifts as a composer and pianist. Even if things did not work out for her, Lina reasoned, sharing the highs of his career would more than allow her to absorb the lows of her own. She would seek to play roles on the stage and in his life. The first of these was that of the long-suffering lady-in-waiting.
At the same time tomorrow, Sean Thomas continues reading The Love and Wars of Lina Prokofiev by Simon Morrison. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer was Elizabeth Allard.
Thank you.
This is BBC Radio 4. It's 12 minutes to 1. Now here's the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 today, Tuesday the 2nd of April. There are warnings of gales in Dover, White, Portland, Plymouth, Shannon and Rockall. The general synopsis at 1800. New low expected 150 miles west of Fitzroy, 985, by 1800 Tuesday. High Fair Isle, 1021, slow moving, intensifying, 1025, by same time. Low Biscay, 999, losing its identity. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira. Northerly or northeasterly, 4 or 5. Fair, good. South Utsira, northerly 3 or 4, becoming variable 3 or less later. Fair, good. 40s. North